Venturously at WORTFM. I will seriously consider your requests. Until next week, gentle listener, take care of yourself.
Hello, I'm Roisin Hasty with the BBC News. Turkey's main opposition party has confirmed that the mayor of Istanbul, who's been charged with fraud and corruption, will be its candidate to challenge President Erdogan at the next election. More than 1,000 people have been arrested by police. Emily Withers reports from Istanbul.
The authorities in Turkey say that over the past 5 days, they've arrested more than 1,100 people at demonstrations by supporters of Mr. İmamoğlu. They say more than 100 police officers have been injured. At least 10 journalists who've been covering the protests are among those who've been detained. Some were taken during dawn raids on their homes. Most media outlets in Turkey are seen as being pro-government, and many are showing very little footage of the demonstrations. The state's regulator has threatened to remove the licenses from those that have.
US and Russian officials have been meeting in Saudi Arabia as President Trump continues to push for a swift end to the war in Ukraine. The White House says the goal is to reach a ceasefire in the Black Sea. Ukrainian officials have described their meeting with American diplomats on Monday as constructive. From Riyadh, here's Frank Gardner.
This is where both the Russian and the Ukrainian delegations have been meeting the Americans, trying to thrash out the technical details of what they can salvage from these ceasefire talks. The Russians are most interested in the Black Sea, the shipping lanes and their ability to export their own products through the Black Sea. The Ukrainians are so far fairly upbeat about this. Once the talks with the Russians are finished, they're going to have another meeting with the Americans, and then they will return to Ukraine. These won't be the last talks. It's just a beginning, so delegates have told us.
The head of the United Nations AIDS programme has warned that there could be nearly 9 million new AIDS infections in the next 4 years as a result of the Trump administration's decision to withdraw funding from the UN's Global Health Programme. Speaking in Geneva, Winnie Bienima called on the US to reconsider the speed of the cuts.
It is reasonable for the United States to want to reduce its funding over time, but the sudden withdrawal of life-saving support is having a devastating impact across countries, particularly Africa, but even in Asia and Latin America. We urge for reconsideration and an urgent restoration of life-saving services.
Japanese weather officials have declared the start of the much-anticipated cherry blossom season in the capital, Tokyo. The announcement was made after 6 flowers appeared on the tree used as the guide to the start of the season. The white and pink flowers arrived exactly on schedule this year. You're listening to the latest world news from the BBC.
When we reached out to our volunteers and to you, our listeners, and asked for your help during the recently concluded Winter Pledge Drive, you responded. Thank you.
If you got a problem, don't care what it is. If you need a hand, I can assure you this. I can help. I got 2 strong arms.
Because of you, we reached our goal for the drive, including matching every dollar of the challenge grant, welcoming 143 new donors, and welcoming back many more. Now, it's our turn to focus on playing the music you love, the news you need, and the civil discussions that make sense of the issues. It's our turn to help.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Budget Bicycle Center's used bicycle showroom located at 930 Regent Street. Open for curbside service estimates and sales, 251-1663. More information on Budget Bicycles services for new and used bicycles is available on the web at budgetbicycleCTR.com.
It's 8:06. You're tuned to the Monday 8 o'clock buzz on WORT 89.9 FM Madison and WORTFM.org. This is Brian Standing. The Wisconsin Supreme Court race gets expensive and nasty. And there's a lot of misinformation about what the Supreme Court actually does. Wisconsin Watch's Jack Kelly has the story. And Donald Trump's illegal deportations of U.S. immigrants to El Salvador are the result of a long, difficult, and complicated relationship between the governments of the United States and of El Salvador. Marco Aguirre of the Madison Arquetao Sister City Project gives us some perspective. And producer Nicholas Wooten takes us on a deep dive into the world of Beatles tribute bands. We'll have all that, plus some announcements, the Outdoor Adventure Report, and some very tasty tunes served up by our engineer, John Wilson. All that's coming up right after this.
She loves.
It's 8:10. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. On March 14th, President Donald Trump invoked the 1798 Alien Enemies Act to deport hundreds of Venezuelans, claiming the immigrants were, quote, an invasion affiliated with the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua. By the next day, hundreds of migrants were on a plane to El Salvador. Despite a federal court order halting the deportation, the captives are presumably now held in the notorious Salvadoran... we'll get back to that in just a second. So I'm sorry about that. So over a century ago, progressives in Wisconsin moved judicial elections to the spring and declared them officially nonpartisan. They hoped to remove the influence of political parties on local government and the judiciary, resulting in a dispassionate, well-reasoned debate removed from party propaganda and influence. Well, to paraphrase Rocky the Squirrel, that trick didn't work. The 2025 Wisconsin Supreme Court race has become the most expensive in history, generating over $50 million in political action committee spending, including from centibillionaire Elon Musk. Vicious attack ads have flooded the commercial airwaves, the internet, and social media, many of which seem to miss the whole point about what the Supreme Court actually does. Wisconsin Watch's Jack Kelly has been following the campaign, and he joins us now by phone. Welcome back to the 8 o'clock buzz.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, and good morning.
Good morning. So one of the prominent things about this race is that Elon Musk's Political Action Committee has donated a tremendous amount of money for it. Musk identified this race for the state Supreme Court as essential to moving President Donald Trump's agenda forward. Has this been typical for how state Supreme Court races have been run?
You know, it's a really interesting question. I would say this is the new normal. You know, it's always unusual when you have the world's wealthiest person weighing in the political race. You know, it's one thing to spend $250 million to help elect the president. It's another thing to dump more than $10 million into a state judicial race. But I think this is the new normal, right? This goes back to 2008 when we saw a really vicious campaign between Michael Gableman and Lewis Butler, outside groups, and primarily through Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, the state's largest business lobby, spent a ton of money. And we've just kind of grown from there, right? I mean, this does feel different than 2023, with the race between Janet Protasiewicz and Dan Kelly, which seemed to break all of the norms of the judicial election. But maybe it only feels that way because you have the world's wealthiest person weighing in, one of the most famous people in the world weighing in. I think we're in a new normal, but you're right. This is probably not what folks envisioned 100 years ago when we switched to judicial elections.
So, you pointed out in your story that a lot of the ads that we're seeing on television and on YouTube and the internet talk about things like sex predators and pedophiles back in the street, talk a lot about, you know, crime and getting people really worried about crimes. How much criminal law does the state Supreme Court deal with?
Well, I mean, they do deal with criminal law. But it's questions of criminal law. Was somebody's Fourth Amendment right violated? Was a procedure from a district attorney or a police officer out of line and some sort of evidence needs to be inadmissible, et cetera? What a Supreme Court justice is not doing is overseeing criminal cases. They are not the people sending offenders to jail or to state prison. They're not putting people on parole, et cetera. That is the work a trial court judge, which both candidates happen to be right now. That's where the fodder for so many of these negative TV ads, which have dominated the airwaves throughout the race, have come from. But in the grand scheme of things, their work as a prosecutor and their work on the bench as a trial court judge, I don't want to say it's completely irrelevant, but it is, it doesn't concern what the justices actually do most of the time.
So in elections going back, there have been, you know, some candidates who sort of refused to talk about their views on the law and said, well, you know, each case to, you know, is should be decided in its own merits. But particularly in 2023, we've seen that start to change, and we've seen these candidates actually articulate some of their legal views ahead of the election. How did that come about?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fine line. Obviously, there are rules for what judicial candidates are allowed to talk about. But I think, you know, you have to take a step back and look at this for what it is, right? I think I mentioned this in the piece. One of the experts that I was talking to made this point. Groups have decided, and whether it's state party, you know, state political parties like the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, or outside groups like Elon Musk's America PAC, or WMC's Issues Mobilization Council, they have decided that it is easier to affect policy change in Wisconsin by weighing in on an election for a single justice than it is, say, trying to win, 15 state legislative seats or 15 or more, like we saw in November when Democrats, you know, thought maybe they had a chance to win the state assembly. And so I think that, candidates start to share their values because they need to send partisan cues to both voters and partisan funders. And accordingly, the money and the votes start to come. So in some ways, it's not surprising. You're talking about your quote-unquote values with voters is the way to win elections. But it is definitely a departure from, the judicial elections of yesteryear, where it was about, being a respected attorney, maybe being a respected local judge, being encouraged by other people in the legal community to run. Things have definitely changed, right? You kind of, in a way, have to be a partisan actor to win statewide election, even though on paper this is a nonpartisan election.
There's also sort of the whole question about whether judges should be elected to begin with. I mean, certainly federal judges are not elected. They're appointed. There seems to be pros and cons on either side. Are there people talking about, hey, is this the best way for us to select people who are going to sit in judgment and ostensibly be objective, but can they be objective if they're also running for election?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. I have spilled a lot of ink about this and talked to a lot of legal experts. And the one thing that they all agree on is that there's no good way to pick a judge. It's complicated and full of biases and is subjective. And I think we know that, right? Here in Wisconsin, we elect our judges. Some people would like to move away from that. But just look a couple states over to our friends in Kansas, and they are right now going through the process of trying to change their system from appointing their state Supreme Court to electing them, because a lot of most of the state Supreme Court has been appointed by Democratic governors, has kind of a liberal bent to it, and it's kind of reined in some of the Republican supermajority and the legislature's policy actions there. So whereas people here might say, we need to move away from judicial elections, all you have to do is drive a couple states over and you have people who are just knocking down the door to get judicial elections.
So there's not a lot of agreement as to what the best way of doing this is.
No, there really isn't. I mean, we have elections in some states. They have what is referred to as the merit selection process. A panel, sometimes the state bar is involved, kind of screens a field of candidates and then passes it along to the governor or a bipartisan commission, and the governor or commission makes the appointment. And then those folks face what they refer to as retention elections. You're basically on the ballot running against yourself. Should this person get to keep their job, yes or no? But no, I mean, when you talk to folks, there's a law professor from the University of Indiana who I've talked to about this. He wrote a book about this. He always says there's no good way to do it. Every system has flaws. And so far, nobody has really cracked the code on what's the best possible way to do this.
So one of the other things about this race that's kind of interesting is that there was only one debate that was scheduled. And I mean, debates often are shown as sort of joint campaign appearances, right? And may or may not. But it certainly seems like that more debates would be an opportunity for candidates to explain a little bit, in their own words, what the Supreme Court actually does, and would be perhaps a little less subject to some of this wildly inaccurate sort of advertising that we're seeing, and at least be able to set the record straight. Is there any appetite for setting a minimum number of debates as part of the electoral process?
You know, that's a great question. I don't know the answer to it. I will say, if you watched the only debate in this race, I don't know if it would actually have given you much perspective on what justices do. There was a lot of talk about crime and public safety. There was a lot of talk about how Elon Musk was trying to buy the election for Brad Schimmel and how George Soros is propping up Susan Crawford. It was not exactly a debate that you might have envisioned 30 years ago. It was a debate that felt much more akin to a partisan political race than to what you might expect from a nonpartisan judicial election.
And I mean, so you mentioned that this is sort of the new normal. What are we to expect in terms of the types of candidates that we're going to be getting in the future, and what the prospects are for getting somewhat dispassionate and accurate information about the race?
Yeah, I mean, unless there are changes to our state's campaign finance laws, I imagine we will continue to see very bloated spending. A little bit of that, I think, will depend on each election, right? So if Susan Crawford wins, for example, liberals will have a guaranteed majority through 2028. So will spending be as dramatic this time next year when we have our next state Supreme Court race? They're not going away. We have one every year for the next 5 years. I don't know. It's hard to say. Will you know, the money come out for conservatives to try to keep it at 4-3 rather than letting liberals maybe get to 5-2? Now, if Schimmel wins, next spring will be the next opportunity for liberals to win back the majority. And so that'll be a contentious, you know, another quote-unquote majority-making election. And will we see crazy spending once again? Probably. So it's really hard to tell. It is a little circumstantial, but I mean, I don't think that we will ever return to the kind of like quaint publicly funded state judicial or state Supreme Court elections of yesteryear that we had here in Wisconsin.
And what are you going to be looking for between now and the election on April 1st? What kind of reporting and coverage are you going to be doing?
Yeah, there's a few things. We will see formal campaign finance filings, hopefully by the end of the day today and Monday. Susan Crawford's campaign did announce her numbers early. She's raised more than $24 million for the cycle, according to her campaign, which means that she's raised something like $17 million just in the last 6 weeks. I'm going to be paying very close attention to who has been giving large sums of money to the state Democratic Party, because I imagine a lot of that $16 million has come from the state Democratic Party. I'm also interested to see how Musk continues to spend in this race. He has really once again used America PAC to kick up the ground game for Brad Schimmel in a similar way that he did for Donald Trump. And of course, Donald Trump is now the president. So clearly something that he did was working, and I'm interested to see if that'll resonate here. And finally, I'm interested to know, will there be a last minute trip from President Donald Trump to Wisconsin to campaign on behalf of Brad Schimmel? I don't know. Schimmel has told supporters that he would like that to happen. We are quickly running out of time, given that we're just 8 days away now. If the president comes, I think that could, it would be really interesting to see what effect it would have on the race, particularly, where in the state he would decide to go. So those are just a couple of things. I imagine a lot is going to happen. We've seen an interesting evolution in this race already over the last couple of weeks, and I'm sure we're in for some more twists and turns 8 days out.
All right. We've been speaking with Jack Kelly, investigative reporter with Wisconsin Watch. You can read Jack's coverage of the Wisconsin Supreme Court race on wisconsinwatch.org. Thank you for joining us on the 8 o'clock buzz.
Thanks so much for having me.
We'll be back with the Outdoor Adventure Report and the Song of the Week coming up right after this.
Accused.
It's 8:25. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. It's time, once again, for the Outdoor Adventure Report with Master Naturalist Paul Noldner. Take it away, Paul.
Thank you, Brother Brian, and WORT for covering all things natural. And happy spring, everybody, watching the natural rhythms of life unfold this spring. Your Outdoor Adventure Report for the week of Monday, March 24th to Sunday, March 30th is brought to you by Paul Noldner, Ambassador of Fun, Friends of Urban Nature, your local parks, environmental, and friends groups helping connect Madison and kids with nearby nature on free, fun, family-friendly guided outings every week year-round. Join the fun. Our bird of the week is bluebirds. As one of my favorite old folk tunes says, here comes the laughing springtime, March will not linger long. Bluebirds have set their wing time. Bluebirds are never wrong. They are cavity nesters and need boxes we help provide in urban parks and natural areas. Here's a shout out to my friend Val, who just took over weekly monitoring of bluebird boxes at Odena Hills, and other bird monitors all around Madison. See cityofmadison.com/parks to join up and be a volunteer. This past week, BIPOC Birding Club hosted a great outing to watch woodcocks do sky dancing. Bird and nature lovers of all ages celebrated the spring equinox and looked for bluebirds, sandhill cranes, cawing, and other spring phenology on naturalist guided walks at the Arboretum, Cherokee Marsh, Ella Leopold, Pheasant Branch, Lakeshore Preserve, and more. Friends of Parks groups met to help support and restore Warner Cherokee, Hartmire, and other Madison parks. Join more outdoor adventures this week. The Friends of Arboretum online native plant sale is a great chance to get a variety of native trees, shrubs, and plants. You can order online at foamadison.org by March 31 for customer pickup in May. You can join a free guided nature hike at the Arboretum on Sunday afternoon, March 30, 1 to 2:30 p.m. Sprouts Nature School, spring programs for kids, start the week of March 31. Join us for cooking, gardening, exploring games, art, and fun for the kids. After-school programs are offered Monday through Friday, and homeschool programs Monday and Wednesday for ages 4 to 12. Learn more and register at sproutsnatureschool.com. Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance is offering a class for learning the ropes of eBird Mobile with a Zoom session on Wednesday, April 2, 6 to 7:30 p.m. and in person Saturday, April 5, 9 to 10:30 at Lake Farm County Park. You will learn how to submit observations, discover birding hotspots, and explore recent sightings all from your phone, and join an instructor for a field trip to practice these skills and see great birds along the way. Registration is 20%. Register now at swibirds.org. Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance is also offering a longer birding 101 class on Saturdays in April from 8 to 10 at Cromery Middle School in Middleton. This is a four-part class, including both classroom and field-based learning geared towards adults. You will learn skills to identify species and practice a new set of birds each week with outdoor bird walks as well as the classroom. Registration is $25 per person, currently open only to Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance members, but you can check that out at swibirds.org to register and for updates. Friends of Cherokee Marsh invite bird lovers to go see white pelicans at Cherokee Lake on Burning Wood Way any day this week. These ungainly yet surprisingly graceful huge white birds form cooperative circles to catch fish and swim elegantly together like ballet dancers. For an early evening birding highlight, head over to the Cherokee Marsh North Unit on North Sherman Avenue and walk the trail east of the parking lot through the prairie to an intersection by the marsh. Bring a blanket, sit quietly as dusk falls to listen for the peent calls of American woodcocks and watch them do their sky dances above the prairie. Tiny woodcocks like big pelicans look ungainly with stubby bodies and short legs, but they're great flyers that can almost hover, being the slowest flyer in the bird world. See the Facebook pages for Friends of Cherokee Marsh for great white pelican pictures by Sheila Leary and BIPOC Birding Club of Wisconsin for woodcock outing pictures by the inimitable Dexter Patterson. More outdoor adventures coming up in April. Sign up at cityofmadison.com/parks to help with Earth Week activities. Mark your calendar for the April 27th Bird and Nature Festival. Find details at cityofmadison.com/parks. and tinyurl.com, Madison Fun Adventures, and social media with your local environmental community and friends groups enjoying springtime outdoors. It's naturally fun.
Thank you, Paul. And now it's time for the song of the week with our engineer, John Wilson. John, what do you have for us?
Well, I'm not too much of a college basketball fan myself, but since it is that time of the year, I thought I would play the aspirational hip-hop classic from 1995 with Skilo's I Wish. And I have to imagine this is maybe the sentiment that the Wisconsin men's basketball team is expressing right at the moment.
Hello? I wish I was a little bit taller. I wish I was a baller. I wish I had a girl who looked good, I would call her. Wish I had a rabbit in a hat with a bat and a 6-4 fall. I wish I was like 6'9" so I could get with Leoshi, cause she don't know me, but yo, she's really fine. You know, I see her all the time, everywhere I go, and even in my dreams, I can scheme a way to make her mine. Cause I know she's living fat, her boyfriend's tall, and he plays ball, so how am I gonna compete with that? Cause when it comes to playing basketball, I'm always last to be picked, and in some cases, never picked it off. So I just lean up on the wall, or sit up in the bleachers with the rest of the girls who came to watch they man ball. Dag y'all, I never understood black, why the jocks get the fly girls, and me, I get the hood rats. I tell them scat, skittles, kabobble. Got hit with a bottle, but sit in the hospital for talking that mess. I confess it's a shame when you living in a city that's the size of a box and nobody knows your name. Glad I came to my senses, like quick, quick, got sick to my stomach. Overcome it by thoughts of me and her together, right? So when I asked her out, she said I wasn't that type. I wish I was a little bit taller, I wish I was a baller. I wish I had a girl who looked good, I would call her. Wish I had a rabbit in a hat with a bat and a 6-4 baller. I wish I was a little bit taller, I wish I was a baller. I wish I had a girl with a good, I would call her. Wish I had a rabbit in a hat with a bat and a 6-4 baller. I wish I had a brand new car, so far I got this hatchback. And everywhere I go, yo, I get laughed at. And when I'm in my car, I'm laid back. I got an 8-track and a spare tire in the back seat, but that's flat. And do you wanna know what's really whack? See, I can't even get a date, so what you think of that? I heard that prom night is a bomb night with a hood ratchet and old type of Rito. Figaro, when in my car, I can't even get a hello. Well, so many people...
Along with our listener sponsors, WRT would like to thank our local business supporters for helping us bring you great shows like this one. We never could have made it to our 50th year without our program underwriters. When you visit these businesses, please take a moment to thank them for their support of WORT. Your acknowledgement of their support really matters. A complete list of our underwriters is on our website at WORTFM.org. Does your business wish to join the party and become a WORT underwriter? Let our listeners know you support independent media. For more information about WORT underwriting, event sponsorships, or to obtain a logo tile on our popular WORT-FM app, contact Doug Holtz at 608-321-9597 or visit the staff page on our website at WORTFM.org.
I like ice cream and I like cake, and I like you to be my friend, be my friend. And you can be my friend on Monday, March 24th, by listening in to the Access Hour at 7 o'clock, when I'll be playing my original songs and hopefully making you laugh on WORT 89.9 FM. Be my friend.
It's 8:33. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. On March 14th, President Donald Trump invoked the 1798 Alien Enemies Act to deport hundreds of Venezuelans, claiming the immigrants were, quote, an invasion affiliated with the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua. By the next day, hundreds of migrants were on a plane to El Salvador. Despite a federal court order halting the deportation, the captives are presumably now held in the notorious Salvadoran CICOT prison. Why did El Salvador President Nayib Bukele agree to imprison Venezuelan immigrants deported from the U.S.? The answer to that and other questions lies in the long and sordid history between the governments of the United States and El Salvador. Marco Aguirre is an American citizen who was originally born in El Salvador and is active with the Madison Arquetau Sister City Project. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to the 8 o'clock buzz, Marco.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
Good morning. So we talked a little bit about this sort of history between the U.S. government and El Salvadoran government. How far back does that relationship go?
El Salvador has been, like many Latin American countries, influenced by U.S. foreign policy for the past 100 years, at the very least. Whether it was a military dictatorship in my country or current president, the U.S. Government has influenced a lot of power throughout its history.
So tell us about President Nayib Bukele. Who is he and how did he come to power in El Salvador?
Nayib Bukele is probably the youngest president, I think, in Latin America. He came to power 6 years ago, a little maybe more, but he came to power as a wave of new voters in El Salvador becoming politically involved and sick of the two-party system that El Salvador had going on. And he wins in a very much a landslide on his very first attempt to run for presidency. He was just the mayor of the capital, but he wins very decisively. And since he got to power, since he became the president, he's consistently became the de facto leader of not just the executive branch, but also the legislative and the judicial branch. At this point, he's amassed so much power, you could very easily say he is basically as close to the dictatorship as he gets.
And tell us about his law and order sort of platform and how that resulted in the creation of the CECOT prison.
So the main reason that Nayib Bukele was able to amass so much power is because he instituted a law that very much canceled civil liberties in El Salvador and started mass apprehension of people that not only were gang members, but looked like gang members, that people just argued were gang members. So since he became president, there is a growth in prisoners up to 100,000 people have been in prison since he became president. And what that resulted in is that all the gang members in the country are in fact in jail, and that gave him a lot of leverage to do whatever he wanted because a lot of people were incredibly happy that the gang members were gone from the streets. And so that allowed him to become not only powerful, but also allowed him to shut down critics, because at this point he's not only all powerful, he has a state of exception that allows him to do whatever he wants.
And is it just gang members that ended up in prison in El Salvador, or did other people get picked up in that sweep?
Absolutely not. In fact, me being part of Madison Arquetau Sister City, the sons of one of our members in Arquetau was in prison without any reason and has been in jail for 3 years now without any sort of legal process, without any sort of reason for them to be. But he remains in jail, and there is no recourse anybody can take once you go to jail. You know, if they want to keep you in jail, you stay in jail.
And what are conditions like in Salvadoran prisons, particularly ones like CECOT?
So CECOT has been on the news, I think national news, international news, because you've seen people being piled together, basically with their head shaved, with very minimal clothing, and just basically in very, I would say, militaristic conditions. The CECOT is known for the images I think a lot of people have seen, However, nobody really knows because the access to the prison is exclusive to the people who are in agreement with the government. There's been a few people, who, mostly YouTubers and a few other people from basically a couple of U.S. senators who've been in there that are in friendly terms with Nayib Bukele. But the conditions are not great. And in fact, people who've been there have been tortured and have shown signs of torture. There is also no guarantees that you'll remain in that prison, and people will often be moved to other prisons that are in much worse conditions. And so it's a bit of a dark prison at this point.
So given all of that and given the large influx of prisoners into the prisons like CCOT, why would Bukele want to take in additional prisoners from elsewhere, such as Venezuelan deportees from the United States? What's in it for Bukele?
There's two stories here, and the official story from Bukele has been that he will get paid enough money to continue operating the prison, which is pretty large and I'm sure expensive. However, Salvadorian journalists currently are writing stories, and there's a few stories out there where, along with the Venezuelans deported to El Salvador, there was some MS-13 gang leaders, Salvadorian MS-13 gang leaders who got deported to El Salvador. Now that would not be a rarity. However, these gang members have been accused of having had illegal dealings with the Salvadorian government. And so they were in prison in New York, accused of having had a truce with the current Salvadorian government. And oddly enough, instead of going to trial in the U.S. where they were accused of this, they were deported back to El Salvador. So there's a sense that there's a quid pro quo here. El Salvador receives these prisoners that the U.S. government doesn't want, and they also get the prisoners that would implicate him in illegal negotiations with them.
So how does the Madison Arquetau sister city project continue to operate under these conditions? What is your current connections with people in Arquetau?
So we still have quite a few members, and we still have, one of our delegations is currently in El Salvador, so we still remain active. We're still able to operate. Arquetau is a small town, fairly far from the capital. Even being that far, we've seen a lot of intimidation to our members in Arquetau. We've seen that the El Salvador government doesn't receive any sort of critique well. And so we're operating in solidarity with them, just trying to amplify their voices, trying to hear their stories. And like I said, we have family of our members who've been imprisoned and have received no answer and no words. So part of our mission is to be able to amplify their voices and let people know what is happening over there.
And is there an active resistance movement in El Salvador, or has that been shut down by the Salvadoran government?
That is a pretty complex question, but I would say there is a citizen movement, the ones resistant movement that became a political party has been basically completely depleted. It is currently fairly dangerous to be in opposition to the government. So a lot of people will be in opposition and a lot of people will speak up, but they will have, government agents following them. They'll have accusations against them that unfounded accusations. So there is a desire to speak up. There is a number of people who are trying. It is currently more difficult than it's been in the past 20 years to be critical of the current government.
All right. We've been speaking with Marco Aguirre of the Madison Arquetau Sister City Project. Thank you so much for joining us on the 8 o'clock buzz.
Thank you.
We'll be back with a deep dive into Beatles tribute bands coming up right after this.
en lo que va del año. Siento cómo me hace daño estar en el mismo lugar. Quiero cambiar.
Good morning. My name is Nicholas Wooten, producer of the Monday 8 o'clock Buzz. It is currently 8:45 a.m. on WORT. If you are a fan of the Beatles and you can hear my voice on the radio, the month of March has plenty to make you twist and shout because the Barrymore Theater plays host to two Beatle tribute bands. Next Sunday, the Fab Four will have you thinking you see John, Paul, George, and Ringo live on stage. A member of that group will talk with Friday Buzz host Andy Moore later this week. But on the Monday Buzz, we turn our attention to a local group that makes no pretense of making you think you were at a Beatles concert unless you use your ears alone. The Madison Mystery Tour performs Beatles songs with note-for-note precision, allowing audiences to share in the joy of the music. Aviv Kamai, is a musician, music teacher, and a founding member of the Madison Mystery Tour. He is also the author of an academic study of Beatles tribute bands and has contributed chapters to two books on the group. I began by asking him to describe the basic types of tribute bands.
Probably the most mainstream type of Beatles tribute acts involve impersonation and dressing up and becoming a character, and not just playing the music, but also providing that visual illusion, if you'd like, of, for the audience members, here I am at the Beatles concert, and also for the performers. So that notion of impersonation got me looking at other acts of impersonation, such as even like Civil War reenactments, and kind of comparing that to the Beatles tribute phenomenon. Also how the Beatles are portrayed as characters on stage was something I was interested in, at. And looking at this whole idea of the event of the Beatles tribute act as some sort of a fantasy, sometimes with elements that really never happened. They're not really reenactments of actual events. For example, you would see in Beatles tribute acts a lot of the times after intermission, the performers return dressed in Beatles' 1967 Sgt. Pepper's suits, and holding their guitars and continuing playing songs from that later period of the Beatles' career, which, of course, this doesn't reenact any live show that happened because the Beatles stopped performing in 1966. But still, that fantasy element continues, almost like, what if? What if the Beatles continue to perform? So you get to see that. And there's these other kind of tribute acts that are less about the visual full immersion component, but more about the details of the music. And therefore, a lot of times these acts will feature more than four people and they won't be characters. There'll be however many musicians are necessary or can be afforded in these acts. And in these acts, the music is almost treated like classical works where you study every part and you play it accurately to the best of what you can do with your ensemble. However, there's no like official published score for all the parts. There are some resources that exist, some books that are great, some books that are more great. And the best tool, since this is a rock, pop genre, would be to use your ears to study the parts, maybe even look for some bootlegs that have earlier takes. So I looked into that work process, which is also the process of my own band, Madison Mystery Tour, that we strive to do, to be as accurate as we can, and when we recreate the Beatles recordings on stage.
And why that choice? Why did you choose to have a note-for-note recreation of the Beatles songs rather than an evocation of the feel of being at the concert, of seeing the Fab Four themselves on stage?
Well, actually, I actually like performing as myself and not as a character. I think part of it, when you're not a character, there's no fourth wall between you and the audience. And I think the interaction seems more authentic to me. I don't have to pretend I'm somebody else. I don't have to create some sort of a fake voice or fake accent when I speak. I speak as Aviv. I don't speak as Paul or John or George or Ringo or George Martin or whoever else was recording on that session. And I feel a connection. I feel we're all on stage and off the stage know what this is about. This is about this music that we all admire and that we get kick out of listening to it, whatever happens. And we're like all inside the music at that moment. And I feel if I had a fake mustache on or a suit or a fake accent, that would distract from the music. Weren't for the music, we wouldn't be sitting here right now having an interview. Because the music is the main thing that made the Beatles the Beatles. So that's the part I like to focus on.
Is the reenactment, does that have any personal interest for you? Is there anything about that that resonates with you personally?
These reenactment or more impersonation shows, they do a phenomenal job. Sometimes you have to like double take to see it's not really the Beatles, right, with their appearance. And I think it's a very strong experience. But me, having been an audience member for these sort of things and watching also a lot of video footage of these events, I'm so focused on the music that, like I said before, it kind of distracts me. I'm not getting the same thrill that I would get from hearing somebody performing the Beatles musically accurately. And if I have to choose between the two, for example, if learning to play left-handed would distract me, would be my focus and I wouldn't be able to play as accurately, then I would go for musical accuracy over visual accuracy.
Are you familiar with the band Rain?
Yes, I am.
Have you seen them?
I've seen videos. I haven't seen them in person.
Yeah. I saw them some years ago at the Overture Center, and they are, reenactors of the Beatles, but they did something that I thought was very interesting. They played I've Just Seen a Face and While My Guitar Gently Weeps. And in both cases, they played them very differently from the way the Beatles ever played them. I've Just Seen a Face, they went on a long musical jam with it. And then While My Guitar Gently Weeps was played much more slowly, much more somberly. And I remember hearing that and thinking, this isn't a reenactment at all. These are cover versions of the song that they're playing. But they felt very true to the Beatles' spirit. I could imagine that had the Beatles continued touring and they hadn't been quite so famous and that was a modification that they might have made, or they might have made something else, but they wouldn't have played it just the way they played it on the White Album, that they would have done something different with it. And this was a proposal for how they might have done it that I thought felt true to me. Have you ever observed anything like that, or have you, as a musician, been tempted to make a modification like that?
Personally, I usually prefer to stay true to the original recordings when we play, but if we don't, I prefer to take it very far. Now, we don't do it a lot on stage. When we go to perform live, we typically just do the note-for-note shtick. But put me by piano or with the guitar and invite people who love the Beatles to sit with me, and I'll be able to I'll be happy and completely in my zone just playing whatever Beatles song on the piano, whether it has piano originally or not, having people sing along. I'll be the happiest man in the world.
Tell me about what you have learned about what your academic study has taught you about Beatles tribute bands, how they are distinct from, say, Civil War reenactors, which you also in your paper talk about to some degree.
So there's a line in the lyrics of the song, I'll Be Back. This time I will try to show that I'm not trying to pretend. I mean, it's really an acrobatic grammatical structure that, you know, probably means more than what it's trying to say. I quoted that line in my paper about Schubert acts because of almost that impossibility of trying to act like the Beatles. The more you try to act, the less like the Beatle, a Beatle you are, in a sense.
Because their act was not an act. I mean, it was and it wasn't at the same time.
Yes, and they had their own language of humor amongst themselves. So they would look at each other and laugh, and nobody in the audience would know why during a live performance. They would make fun of their own more kind of serious endeavors, again, because to remind themselves and to remind us, they are four lads from Liverpool, and they'll definitely make sure if John tries to do something smart and artistic, trust me, the others will remind him who really is. And, you know, they can do that at the same time. That's the beauty of the Beatles. And I think that attracts people to them, that they have this humor that also they directed themselves to not take themselves too seriously. But at the same time, they create magnificent art. So you can have later in the album, Let It Be, came out in May of 1970. You have the song Let It Be, which is such an artistic achievement and definitely a serious song that takes itself seriously. So it's there. But at the same time, right before it, you have this falsetto mockery that John says, now I'd like to do, hark, the angels come. And then after that, you have Maggie May, which is this old Liverpool song, not exactly the same artistic register as Let It Be. So both things happen at the same time. It's almost like a very special recipe that the Beatles had. There are many examples of that throughout their career. So I'm thinking, trying to imitate that on stage with your banter is quite hard to be that, to try to be serious and not at the same time, to try, in a sense, to be like the Beatles. So that's what I meant by that impossible quote that I added there to my paper.
This is such great fun to have a conversation with another Beatles fanatic.
This has been such a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. I want to mention who my bandmates are that I've been talking about this whole time.
Oh, please do, yes.
Jeff Blakehorst, Sean Michael Dargan, Bill Getchow, and Dr. Stephen Morgan.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah.
That was Aviv Kameh, member of the Madison Mystery Tour, talking about Beatles tribute bands with Monday Buzz producer Nicholas Wooten. You can learn more about Kameh's work at madisonmysterytour.com.
Never been a digging this good for this long, this hood, for this pop, this hot, for this strong, with so many different flows. This one's for this song, the next one I switch up, this one will give it up. These oaks too lazy to make up, they crazy, they don't paint pictures, they just trace me. You know what, soon they forget where they pluck, they hold staff and they try to reverse the outcome. I'm like, tough, I'm not a writer, I'm a writer for myself and others. I say a big verse, I'm only big enough my brother, big enough my barrel, I'm big enough to do it, I'm that barrel, plus I know my own flow is foolish. So the rings and things you sing about, bring them out. It's hard to yell when the barrel's in your mouth. I'm in new sneakers, dual seaters, few divas. What more can I tell you? Let me spell it for you. W-I-L-L-I-E. Nobody truer than H-O-V. And I'm back for more. New York's ambassador. Prime Minister, back and finish my business up.
It's 8:58, and that wraps up our program today. I'd like to thank our guests, Wisconsin Watch reporter Jack Kelly, Madison Arkatow, Sister City Project's Marco Aguirre, Aviv Kameh from Get Back Wisconsin, and the Madison Mystery Tour. And thanks to our producer, Nicholas Wooten, who lined up the great guests you heard here today. Also, thanks for the interview with Aviv Kameh, and it kept everything running smoothly down here at the station. Thanks to our engineer, John Wilson, who piloted the mighty WORT soundboard and spun all the great tunes. This is WORT 89.9 FM Madison. If you missed some of today's broadcast, or if you'd like to hear extended versions of many of our interviews, check out our archives and podcasts at WORTFM.org. My name is Brian Standing. Global Revolutions is coming your way right after the Insurgent Radio Kiosk.
I'm 30 plus, give me a crisp pair of jeans with his button ups. S-dots on my feet make my sights complete. What more can I say? Guru, play the beat. We gon' let this ride into the hook. I'ma snap my fingers on this. What more can I say to you? Get my throne back on. Let's go. Now you know your ass is Willy when they got you in the bag, but like half a Billy, and your ass ain't Lily White. That mean that issue right must be illy. Either that or your flow is silly. It's both. I don't mean to boast, but damn if I don't brag, them crackers gon' act like I ain't on their ass. The Martha Stewart that's far from Jewish, far from a Harvard student, just had the balls to do it. And no, I'm not doing it. In fact, I'm just previewing it. This ain't the show, I'm just EQing it. 1-2 when I won't stop abusing it. Girl, stop false accusing it. Back to the music, the Maybach roof is translucent.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Monday, March 24th.
Can two welcoming posters get a sixth grade teacher fired? I'm Bill Newman for the Civil Liberties Minute. At the Lewis and Clark Middle School in Meridian, Idaho, a sixth grade history teacher, Sarah Inama, has been ordered to take down two posters in her classroom. One poster says that everyone in the classroom is welcome, important, accepted, respected, encouraged, valued, and equal. The other poster is an illustration of raised hands with different skin tones under the caption, "Everyone is welcome here." The school district says that it's the different skin tones on the children's hands that make the poster controversial and violate the school policy that says that classroom decorations must be content neutral. Content neutral? According to the school, the policy, quote, is intended to ensure that no one group is targeted or offended by the display of certain items. Say what? Who? What group is being targeted by posters that say everyone is welcome here? Who could possibly be offended? The answer? People who are offended by the idea of equality. That everyone is welcome poster has been up in the classroom for the past 4 years. The reason for the edict now? Well, times and politics, the administration has explained, have changed. And if the teacher doesn't remove the posters by the end of the school year, she faces discipline, up to and including termination. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU.